89.9 FM Madison.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, May 5th edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. Later in the program, UW-Madison PhD student and Library Mall resident and Students for Justice in Palestine member Dalia Saba will come into the studio to talk with us about what's happening with the encampment on the UW-Madison campus, as well as any news she can give us about Gaza and Palestine. But first, we have the news.
As Kenya and Tanzania brace for the arrival of Cyclone Hidaya on the heels of torrential rains and floods that have devastated East Africa, meteorologists and humanitarians are looking at why Africa is so vulnerable to suffering natural disasters such as floods, severe storms, and droughts. Since the majority of Africans depend on rain-fed agriculture for their food, flooding and drought make their food supplies insecure. Increasingly, the effects of climate change are quickening the pace of recurring disasters, which leave poor nations without the resources to respond to an initial disaster before they're hit by another. Some disasters are the result of environmental degradation, such as increased settlements, deforestation, livestock grazing, and clearing for crops that make the environment susceptible to the effects of erosion after severe weather events. In urban areas, the expansion of many of Africa's cities sees people building shelters along rivers and on wetlands, destroying natural buffers for floodwaters. According to the World Meteorological Organization, the damage caused by a disaster can be reduced by nearly one-third if an early warning is issued within 24 hours. Last year, the organization launched an initiative to try to give more Africans access to an early warning system about impending disasters. Nature-based solutions such as preserving forests and wetlands to reduce flooding are also being discussed, but people affected will need to see the value of these efforts.
The World Health Organization says that more than 50 million measles deaths have been averted through vaccinations since 2000. But widespread insecurity in northern Nigeria disrupts vaccination campaigns, leaving children there particularly vulnerable. Nigeria's health commissioner reported on Friday that at least 42 people have died from a measles outbreak in just over a week in Nigeria's northeastern state of Adamawa, and nearly 200 suspected cases were identified. Since armed Boko Haram groups began attacking Nigerians in 2009, more than 2 million people have fled their homes. Criminal gangs have also made northern Nigeria more dangerous. Doctors Without Borders said earlier this year that the inability of public health services in Nigeria to achieve the 95% vaccination rate required to suppress measles led to an alarming rise in the number of people affected by the virus last year. It said it treated almost 4,000 patients between October and December. A Doctors Without Borders team member in Nigeria said, quote, one infected child can spread the virus to between 9 and 12 other unvaccinated children, unquote. The Adamawa State's health commissioner said that vaccines have been released and field teams are containing the situation there.
Three Indian nationals have been arrested and charged over the killing of a Sikh separatist leader in Canada, which sparked a major diplomatic conflict between Canada and India. Hardeep Singh Nijjar was shot dead last June by masked gunmen in a busy parking lot in a Vancouver suburb. Nijjar was a Sikh separatist leader who publicly campaigned for Khalistan, the creation of an independent Sikh homeland in the Punjab region of India. The diplomatic disagreement escalated after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau alleged India's government may have been involved, and India strongly denied the allegation. In announcing the arrests on Friday, Superintendent Mandeep Mukher said the three suspects had been in Canada for 3 to 5 years, had been living in Edmonton, Alberta, where they were arrested, and that they had been charged with first-degree murder as well as conspiracy to commit murder. Police said that investigations were continuing, including into connections to the government of India. They said there may be others involved in the killing, and there may be further arrests or charges. Investigators have been working with counterparts in India, but the collaboration has been, quote, rather difficult and rather challenging, unquote, for several years, they said. India's Foreign Minister Subramaniam Jaishankar said the country would await for Canadian police to share information on those arrested.
A North Korean propaganda tune has gone viral on TikTok with a bouncy melody and Korean lyrics praising Kim Jong-un, who has vowed to, quote, thoroughly annihilate the U.S., unquote. Gen Z users are bopping around to the synthy electropop, oblivious to the lyrics. And experts say the sunny pop tune hides something more sinister. They say there's more than commercial considerations when writing a pop tune in North Korea, since authorities want an earworm that penetrates minds. Melodies have to be simple, accessible, something people can easily pick up, and pitched at a vocal range where they can be sung by most people. Alexandra Leonzini, a Cambridge University scholar who researches North Korean music, says, quote, all artistic output in North Korea must serve the class education of citizens, and more specifically, educate them as to why they should feel a sense of gratitude, a sense of loyalty to the party, unquote. This 2-minute track released last month has an alarming new message, according to North Korea watchers. Kim Jong-un is getting more aggressive and growing into his leadership role. And as the song says, quote, let's sing Kim Jong-un, the great leader. Let's brag about Kim Jong-un, our friendly father, unquote. And if you want to hear the song, you can go to the BBC website and the Korean news. And it's got a jaunty YMCA type video to go with it.
Wonderful. Heavy rains in the southern Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul have left 66 dead and 101 missing as of this morning. Storms in the past few days have affected nearly two-thirds of the 500 cities and towns in the state. Floods destroyed roads and bridges and have triggered landslides and the partial collapse of a dam at a small hydroelectric power plant. A second dam in the city of Bento Gonçalves is also at risk of collapse. In the state's capital of Porto Alegre, the Guaíba Lake broke its banks, flooding streets. The city's international airport has suspended all flights for an indefinite period. Rains are expected in the northern and northeastern regions of the state in the next 36 hours, but the volume of precipitation has been declining. Rio Grande do Sul, which borders Uruguay and Argentina, is at a geographical meeting point between tropical and polar atmospheres that has created a weather pattern with periods of intense rain and drought. Local scientists believe the pattern has been intensifying due to the climate crisis. Last September, heavy rains hit the state as an extratropical cyclone caused floods that killed more than 50 people. That came after more than 2 years of a persistent drought due to the La Niña phenomenon, during which the region saw only scarce showers.
Haiti's Transitional Council nominated an interim prime minister early last week, but has since walked back its decision. Former sports minister Fritz Belizaire was chosen Tuesday to lead the council, but late Wednesday night, four of the council's seven voting members issued a statement saying they will go back to an original agreement of April 3rd to choose a prime minister from a pool of applicants. This exposed the internal turmoil of the group that's been tasked with putting the Caribbean country out of crisis. As leaders squabble to make a decision, Haitians have demanded that they prioritize public safety. On Thursday, gunmen launched a new attack in Port-au-Prince, the capital, exchanging gunfire with police for hours. The attack forced hundreds to flee their homes as gangs started, quote, burning everything in sight, unquote. More than 2,500 people have been killed or injured from January to March of this year, a more than 50% increase compared with the same period last year, according to the UN. An international force financed by the U.S. and led by Kenya claims to be prepared to deploy in the near future, awaiting completion of their headquarters and barracks by U.S. contractors. In the meantime, Haitian police struggle to control government buildings and to maintain some order.
Hundreds of Tunisians demonstrated yesterday in central Tunisia to demand the rapid evacuation of thousands of migrants from sub-Saharan African countries who are now in Tunisia. Last September, thousands of migrants set up shelters in temporary camps where they wait until they have the opportunity to surreptitiously migrate to Italy from the beaches about 15 kilometers from the city. Tunisia, along with Libya, represents one of the main departure points for irregular migrants crossing the Mediterranean towards Italy and the rest of Europe. In recent weeks, Tunisian police destroyed shelters in several camps following complaints from angry residents. According to the Tunisian Forum for Economic and Social Rights, hundreds of migrants were forcibly evacuated on Friday from camps set up in front of the United Nations agencies headquartered in the capital, Tunis, and were deported to the Algerian border post in a security operation aimed at confronting various manifestations that disturb public security.
Members of the Turkish Humanitarian Relief Foundation, or IHH, continue to sit in for the 11th day in a row in a major square in Istanbul in support of Palestine. The protesters carried banners in Turkish and English with phrases such as, quote, sit for a few minutes with us for the sake of Palestine, unquote, or don't be silent, children are being killed, and there is a genocide in Gaza, unquote. In addition to other banners denouncing the Israeli attacks on Gaza. The sit-in continues daily from 3 to 10 p.m. local time. It has been attended by members of the Freedom Flotilla, which is preparing to set off from Istanbul to Gaza to break the siege. The sit-in also includes collecting donations for Gaza through the IHH. And those are our headlines for today. Now, here's Gil with our first longer story.
In mid-April of 2022, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced a deal his government had made with Rwanda to decrease the number of migrant crossings of the English Channel and stop human smuggling. People that the UK identified as illegal immigrants or asylum seekers would be relocated to Rwanda for processing, asylum, and resettlement. In return, the UK would pay Rwanda £120 million and give each immigrant between £20,000 and £30,000 for relocation and settlement in Rwanda. The UK would also accept an unspecified number of the, quote, most valuable refugees living in Rwanda. Asylum claims for migrants from Britain would be processed in Rwanda. Successful migrants would receive permanent residency in Rwanda and offered permanent accommodation. The first flight was scheduled for June 14th of last year, no, of 2022, for some 30 people. But that evening, the government confirmed the flight would not depart because the European Court of Human Rights successfully took measures to delay and investigate its legality. In December of 2022, the UK High Court of Justice ruled the plan lawful, but the Court of Appeals ruled in June 2023 that the plan was unlawful because Rwanda is not a safe country. New Prime Minister Rishi Sunak vowed to appeal the verdict at the Supreme Court of the UK. At the Supreme Court hearing last October, the government argued that Rwanda could be trusted to treat refugees humanely. Lawyers for the migrants described the country as, quote, an authoritarian one-party state with a, quote, woefully deficient asylum system. The court found the plan unlawful on the grounds of deficiencies in Rwanda's asylum system. In December of 2023, the UK government concluded a new treaty with Rwanda and introduced the Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Act of 2024, which was passed last month, April 23rd. After many rounds of parliamentary discussion, the act overrules the judgments and declares Rwanda a safe country. Demonstrations were held outside the Home Office the day the policy was announced, and charities warned of Rwanda's human rights violations. No airlines could be found to transport the deportees. While Rwandan President Paul Kagame defended the plan, the Rwandan opposition claimed that the country was not prepared for new immigrants and criticized the policy as dealing with British issues when they should deal with Rwanda first. The United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees is, quote, firmly opposed to the policy, believing it to be unlawful, prejudiced, and impractical. The labor union representing UK civil servants has launched a legal challenge to the UK's Rwanda policy, fearing that implementing it will force civil servants to breach international law. Other legal challenges are expected. The UK has begun detaining asylum seekers to send to Rwanda. It ultimately hopes to send some 6,000 people this year, but given the opposition to the plan, it appears those hopes will remain unfulfilled or at least delayed.
Colombian President Gustavo Petro announced Wednesday that his country would be severing diplomatic ties with Israel over its military deployment in Gaza. This ends an almost 70-year relationship that allowed Colombia to purchase Israeli military and chemical industry supplies. Concerns over Israel's possible ground offensive in Rafah, which United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres said would mark an, quote, unbearable escalation, unquote, appear to have triggered the break. Petro said, quote, here in front of you, the government of change of the President of the Republic announces that tomorrow we will break diplomatic relations with the State of Israel for having a government, for having a president who is genocidal, unquote. Petro has been one of Israel's most vocal critics in the Latin American region since the start of the conflict. He is part of a progressive wave of leaders known as the Pink Tide, which recently came to power in the region. In October, Petro accused Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant of using language similar to that of the Nazis, of what the Nazis said of the Jews, when Gallant said the country was fighting human animals. Israel announced it would halt security exports to Colombia. A month later, Petro accused Israel of committing genocide. In February, Colombia suspended Israeli weapons purchases after Israeli forces opened fire on Palestinians scrambling for food aid in Gaza, an event Petro said, quote, recalls the Holocaust, unquote. Last month, Colombia requested to join a case in the International Court of Justice that accused Israel of genocide. There was no immediate response from Israel, but then Petro was met with fury by Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz, who said, quote, "The president of Colombia has promised to give a reward to the Nazi Hamas murderers, and here it is today. History will remember that Gustavo Petro decided to side with the most despicable monsters known to mankind, who burned babies, murdered children, raped women, and kidnapped innocent civilians," unquote. The Palestinian Authority said, quote, "The noble stances taken by friendly Colombia constitute an example for the world to follow, for binding the Israeli occupation to the resolutions of international legitimacy," unquote. It added that the international community should take a more decisive stance regarding crimes of genocide. Colombia joins the list of Latin American countries that have broken diplomatic ties with Israel. Bolivia cut ties with Israel last fall, while Cuba has not recognized the country since 1973, and Venezuela has not recognized it since 2009.
At least 15 pro-Syrian government fighters were killed in attacks launched by ISIS on military sites in central Syria on Friday. In March 2019, the Syrian Democratic Forces defeated most of the ISIS fighters, who scattered in the Syrian desert areas and continued to carry out attacks targeting pro-government forces and Kurdish forces allied with the United States. There are about 900 U.S. troops in Syria, in the northeast and farther south along the Iraqi border. The U.S. Central Command reported on Thursday, a year after the incident, that, quote, "On May 3, 2023, the United States conducted a unilateral counterterrorism airstrike in northwest Syria, targeting a senior al-Qaeda leader. The investigation determined U.S. forces misidentified the intended al-Qaeda target and that a civilian, Mr. Lufti Hassan Masto, a shepherd, was struck and killed instead. A Syrian military source reported last Thursday that 8 of their soldiers were injured in what he described as, quote, an Israeli attack, unquote, on a site in the vicinity of Damascus, the Syrian capital. The Israeli-launched airstrike came from the direction of the Syrian Golan Heights, which is under illegal Israeli occupation. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that the Thursday night attack had targeted a security training center affiliated with the Lebanese Hezbollah. Early last month, Israel targeted the Iranian consulate in Damascus, killing 7 members of the Revolutionary Guard, including 2 commanders, one of whom was the most senior Iranian military official in Syria. Since the outbreak of the conflict in Syria in 2011, Israel has carried out hundreds of airstrikes targeting the Syrian army and others fighting alongside the Syrian government forces. The pace of Israeli strikes has increased since its war on the Islamic resistance movement Hamas in the Gaza Strip began on October 7th. Israel rarely comments on its strikes in Syria, but it stresses that it will not allow Iran to establish presence in the neighboring country. Iran has reduced its military presence in Syria to about 3,000 military advisors from the Revolutionary Guard, assisting government forces in areas on the borders with Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, and Israel.
The Israeli regime today shut down the news organization Al Jazeera, one of the last remaining international media networks reporting on Israel's genocidal war on the Palestinians trapped in the Gaza Strip and the ongoing Israeli military occupation of the Palestinian West Bank and East Jerusalem. Israel's Minister of Communications ordered an immediate 45-day closure after the Israeli parliament last month approved a bill allowing the temporary closure of foreign broadcasters, including Al Jazeera. After 45 days, the closure could be renewed indefinitely. Al Jazeera's bureau chief in Palestine reported that the Israeli occupation forces also confiscated all of their broadcast equipment. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, quote, "The government headed by me unanimously decided the incitement channel Al Jazeera will be closed in Israel," unquote. Reporters Without Borders, or RSF, condemned the Israeli decision with repressive legislation to censor the channel for its coverage of the war in Gaza. This follows months of an Israeli campaign of incitement against the Qatar-based network and the killing of family members of Al Jazeera journalists. Last month, Al Jazeera accused Netanyahu of executing a frantic campaign against it, saying, quote, he could not find any justifications for his ongoing attacks on Al Jazeera, so he presented new lies and inflammatory slander against the network and the rights of its employees, unquote. In 2022, Palestinian-American Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by an Israeli sniper while reporting in the Palestinian refugee camp Jenin. The Israeli occupation army initially denied killing her, but months later admitted she was likely killed by an Israeli soldier. From when the war on Gaza began on October 7, 2023, and until last Friday, at least 97 journalists and media workers have been among the more than 35,000 Palestinians killed, 34,000 of them in Gaza alone. The Israeli occupation forces informed Reuters and Agence France-Presse news agencies during the first days of the Gaza slaughter that it could not guarantee the safety of any journalists operating in the Gaza Strip war zone. And that's a wrap of news from around the world for Sunday, May 5th, 2024. I'm Lee Rowe.
And I'm Gil Halstead.
Sources we used to prepare today's stories were Agence France-Presse, Anadolu Agency, Al Jazeera, Associated Press, BBC, the Committee to Protect Journalists, Deutsche Welle, France 24, Globo News, The Guardian, Kenya Tribune, Middle East Eye, Merco Press, The Miami Herald, Middle East Monitor, New York Times, Reporters Without Borders, Reuters, SANA, UNHCR, The Washington Examiner, Wikipedia, and the World Health Organization.
موطني موطني الجلال والجمال والسناء والبهاء في رباك في رباك والحياة والنجاة والهناء والرجاء في هواك هل أراك سالما منعما وغانما مكرما هل أراك في علاك تبلغ السماك موطني الشباب لن يكل همه أن يستقل.
Welcome to the Worldview feature for this May the 5th. I'm Gil Halstead, I'm your host, and joining me today in the studio is Dalia Saba. She is a first-year graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison here in electrical engineering, and she's a member of the UW-Madison chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine. Her father is Palestinian and was born in Gaza, And until recently, she had family members in Gaza, but the past week they were fortunately able to evacuate to Egypt. I'd like to welcome you again to WORT. Welcome back to WORT.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. So, can whatever update you can give us about what the status of the encampment is right now, because my understanding is that there was to be a meeting, and maybe that's changed in terms of time, right around this time to sort of update people on what's been going on with negotiations with the chancellor and what next steps might be. So whatever you feel comfortable telling me what you know about.
Yeah. So yesterday there was a meeting with the chancellor where the demands were discussed, or not with the chancellor, but with the administration, where the demands were discussed in a bit more detail. I was not personally in the negotiations, but I have been in communication with the negotiators. We presented a proposal for ethical investments to guide the, you know, where the university puts its money based on several ethical lines, and discussed, for example, the UW Foundation, and also discussed the presence of police on this campus. I think the next meeting has not yet been scheduled. There are plans to continue meeting and continue negotiating, but I don't have a specific update yet on when that would be.
Right. And so I'm thinking about how things have been going on different campuses along both of those lines across the country right now, in terms of both the divestment demands that students here have and students in other campuses have as well, and about the presence of or use of police in dealing with the encampment. So first of all, I want to ask you, what's your sense of what information students have at this point about what the investments are that they would like to see divested from right now? And is there work going on to try to look into what those investments are and what you have been objecting to? Because I understand the demands are two. It's to disclose and divest. And if we don't know what the investments are, how can we know what to demand the divest from?
Exactly. I mean, I think one thing that's really important to consider here is that, you know, the UW is a public institution in theory, but it's been set up in such a way that it is completely unaccountable to students and taxpayers, because the investment arm of the UW is the UW Foundation, which is a private institution. But what we do know, there are some limited amounts of the UW Foundation's money that is public. For example, its investments in BlackRock. And I think the Daily Cardinal did some pretty good reporting on a specific ETF that the UW holds through BlackRock that is invested in like weapons manufacturing. And I think that's like $8 or $9 million. And again, that's just the tip of the iceberg that we have access to.
Right.
We do know that the UW is invested in, arms manufacturing and other things that are directly enabling the ongoing genocide in Gaza. But it is set up as a completely non-transparent institution.
Right. And so as those negotiations go on, your hope is that that kind of information will become available. And until then, that divestment actually occur before students would at least voluntarily dismantle the encampment? Is that really the stance right now?
Our stance is that we need to have an actual commitment to divestment, not just a promise to think about it down the line, because we know that that's how universities crush student movements, is by setting up committees to set up other committees to go on for long enough that the students don't realize what's happening. And so we're just looking to see, you know, of course the university has its own institutions and decision-making processes, and like it takes time to move money around. But we want to see a serious commitment to doing that, you know, that is actually binding. And that's what it would mean for us to have our demands met.
Right. So basically a roadmap, steps, that this is what we're going to take first and second and third, that kind of thing. Okay. And let's shift then to one of the other major demands, which has to do with the use of police on campus to enforce the rules against such an encampment. it appears that the only one that I have read about so far, in terms of an institution like the University of Wisconsin, the University of Minnesota, there have been apparently some commitments there. And from what I've read online, that encampment is being voluntarily dismantled. Have you heard anything? Is that, I'm really curious about whether news between the student organizations across the country, whether there's any kind of cross communication going on or interaction.
Yeah. I can't speak to the University of Minnesota specifically. Okay. I can speak to other encampments that we've seen make deals.
Yeah.
I think from our perspective, we want to make sure that our deal is an actual commitment to accountability in future investing principles. And that's why we've been putting forward, you know, in our minds, actionable proposals of like, we don't want to hear you just talk about how you value students' input. We want to hear you say, these are material principles that we will use going forward to evaluate where we put our money. For example, we won't invest in arms manufacturers. We won't invest in companies complicit in the occupation. We won't invest in companies that do environmental degradation. These kinds of things that I think are broadly popular among students and community members.
Right. And there are all sorts of, there's plenty of investment companies and investment managers out there who've designed a wide range of packages,
yeah,
right, that are available for investment. But on the question of police, I know you've been on our air just a couple of days ago on Friday talking about what happened on Wednesday. What are the demands in terms of when and how police would be called? Are you actually calling for like eliminating the University of Wisconsin Police Department or?
So, yeah. So, I mean, this is not a new demand from this encampment. As I'm sure many of the listeners are aware, this demand, was brought up prominently in 2020 by predominantly Black students and other marginalized students on campus who said, the police force here does not make us feel safe. And we've seen it, you know, on Wednesday, again, that these police are used to weaponize or to brutalize students, and specifically students of color. You know, we saw all of the faculty arrested were faculty of color. So I think the question really that we have for the university is, why are you spending our money on a, you know, an armed institution? They have, you know, weapons that they bring through that is used to attack students. And why is the university have its own individual police force when there were three other police forces around? So I think this is, again, not a new demand. It's rather the continuation of another demand that the university has not made significant progress towards.
And there has been concern across all of the campuses, including here at the University of Wisconsin, from the administration side, that the need to dismantle the encampment is based on a responsibility that the university claims it has to defend and to protect Jewish students on campus. So if you could talk a little bit about what kind of interaction, if there has been any, with Jewish students on campus, or information you've heard about students actually being threatened or that kind of thing happening.
Well, one instance I can speak to is that last night there were some, some specifically Zionist students who came to, you know, host a Havdalah, but as kind of, you know, explicitly on the lawn. And I know several Jewish students as part of the encampment who tried to join in the prayer and were told explicitly, you are not Jewish enough, you cannot be here. That is the instance of Jewish students being attacked at UW. This is the one that I have heard of directly.
Okay.
And I think it's important when we talk about student safety that we talk also about the Muslim and Palestinian students who have been attacked.
Of course, yeah.
You know, when we talk about student safety.
Right. So other than that, I have not heard reports, but other than that particular one of actual threats from students involved in the encampment against Jewish students anywhere on campus.
No, and I think that like in the encampment, we've made it very clear that this is a space for people of all backgrounds and all faiths and all religions and all ethnicities, because really what we're fighting for is basic human rights for Palestinians. And that's something that isn't specific to any one background or any one faith.
And maybe shifting even a little bit away from the major focus of this encampment and all of the encampments across the country, which are focused on what is happening in Gaza, the war in Gaza. But the investments that you're talking about divesting from in arms manufacturing are being used all over the world. The companies that are producing these and that UW is benefiting from in terms of their investment are involved in selling weapons to places, to governments all over the world,
yeah,
that are involved in wars against other peoples, not just against Palestinians, right?
Yeah, and I think that really, you know, when people say our struggles are connected, that's really what we mean, is that it's the same, you know, maybe it's not the exact same company, but it's the same set of companies that are participating in the same thing, and they share technology. They share all of these things with each other. And so it's kind of a matter of basic moral consistency. And so when we talk about, like, Palestine is the forefront of justice, when we free Palestine, you know, justice starts with Palestine. That doesn't mean that Palestine is more important than human rights anywhere else. What it means is that Palestine is the heart of so many of these problems. And by addressing that, we address these injustices everywhere.
And so I think you've basically answered this question, but the difference between the genocidal conflicts going on across the world. I mean, I'm bringing this up because I heard an interview on BBC recently that was the BBC news host interviewing Bernie Sanders and challenging Bernie for having described what is going on in Gaza right now. And he actually didn't use the word genocidal. He's called it ethnic cleansing. So, I mean, what is the real difference there? And the interviewer was saying, you know, is it really the same as what's happened, for example, to the Rohingya in Burma or to other places, making those kinds of comparisons? What do you think about whether that's a significant kind of challenge to say that, is it really genocide?
Yeah, I mean, there have been numerous genocide scholars, you know, scholars who have started by studying other genocides historically, such as the Holocaust, the Bosnian genocide, you know, all of these historical things, who have called it a genocide based on scholarly research. You can look through the genocide convention and see, okay, it says if one of these things has been met, it counts as a genocide. 5 out of 6 have. The other thing is that the International Court of Justice, you know, South Africa brought a hearing charging the state of Israel with genocide. Of course, that court takes a long time to make decisions, but they came back with a preliminary ruling and said, we find this case plausible. And I think that it is important to highlight, you know, if people are uncomfortable with the word genocide because it's a legal term that hasn't been officially ruled on yet, I understand that. But I think we have to acknowledge the scale of what's happening here, right, and the urgency of what's happening here, the mass violence.
And so let's talk about what's been going on at the encampment right now, because the other news headline I heard recently was actually on National Public Radio, and I didn't listen to the whole story, but it was basically kind of an accusation or a characterization of the current encampments going on right now across the country from someone who was a veteran of the anti-apartheid in South Africa campaigns. And the little clip they used was to say that it didn't seem to him that there was really any actual teaching going on at a lot of these campus encampments, and I think suggesting that it was just students, you know, spending all their time chanting and making demands. But what's been happening at the UW-Madison encampment, from my brief visits to it, seems to me that there has been actual teaching going on.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've had, you know, different types of education, including, for example, this afternoon, Dr. Samer Al-Tut, a Palestinian sociologist, gave a very good lecture on the history of Palestine and Palestinian resistance. We have, you know, multiple teach-ins a day. We have film screenings. You know, we showed a film last night about Palestinian rock climbers. but we also have cultural education, and we have education about people's own, you know, from different backgrounds, because as we discussed earlier, it's not just about Palestine. Of course, it's about Palestine. That's central. But about different, the, you know, interconnectedness of different struggles throughout history. You know, we had someone talk about the music of the civil rights movement. We've had, you know, cultural education about like body awareness and trauma. And so I think that, you know, we've been out here a long time. We've talked about a lot of different things and, you know, over the past week or so. But I think for people who are interested, we post our schedules pretty regularly and we have a lot of teachings.
In fact, I was trying to find the most recent schedule for today. I was looking at the Badger Herald and the Cardinal had something, but it really just had from Saturday. But I can, you just mentioned one of the things that happened today, and yesterday there was a printmaking class in the morning. There was a teach-in on disability justice and Palestinian liberation also at 11:30 in the morning. There was a Kids for Palestine story time. There was a teach-in at 5 on collective care and liberation movements, and a guest speaker at 6, and then a dance at 7. So, I mean, it sounds sort of like it is a little mini university teach-in kind of thing going on. It reminds me of what happened when I was a student in the 70s, soon after the anniversary we just experienced of the killings of Kent State students on the Kent State campus. There were teach-ins all over camp. There was teach-ins on the campus I went to that was just bringing... It was the institution continuing to be an educational institution, but students had basically taken it over and brought in other resources to do the teaching. And it sounds like that's what's happening here too.
Exactly. And I think what we've seen is that, like, you know, the moniker for these encampments is the Popular University for Gaza. And I think that is quite literal. We see that, you know, it's a popular university in that we have people from not just the school, not just faculty members, including faculty members, but other, you know, community members who have this knowledge rooted in other experiences, other social justice movements. And we also are able to talk about things that the university does try to censor. For example, the university does not want us to talk openly about Palestine. And we've seen that in the way that they've treated this protest as opposed to other protests or other people who decide to hang out on a lawn, you know?
Yeah, and speaking of other people who hang out on the lawn, well, I guess we, in a sense, already talked about that in terms of that Zionist or pro-Israeli Jewish students have come and spent time, at least around the edges of the encampment, and have been able to carry out the activities that they were carrying out. And unfortunately, there was wasn't welcoming. But do you feel that your encampment there is welcoming to all students from all perspectives? Because I know one of the guidelines or rules is not to engage with provocateurs or counter-protesters.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we've seen here and elsewhere across the country that there are people who are coming in explicitly with bad intentions to try to agitate and get a soundbite or whatever. But that isn't everybody. And I think it's important to say that, like, we are open to people who both, you know, are already know about this cause and want to support, and also to people who don't know about this and want to learn more. I've personally had conversations at the encampment with people who, you know, were raised with Zionism and wanted to learn more about, like, wait, why are you guys here? This doesn't make sense with what I've been told. Mm-hmm. And so these are conversations that we're welcome, like, you know, we want to have, and we want to use this as a space to both advocate for our demands and advocate to end the UW's complicity in the genocide, but also to, you know, build an understanding of what is the struggle for Palestinian solidarity really about here.
Right, and getting into that a little bit more is a more sensitive or delicate question that has come up in conversations I've had with friends and relatives and people that I know about this, about the war in Gaza, and about the protests against it, including the campus protests, but others that have been going on, and debates in Congress. What about the Hamas attacks and the hostages? There is not any really explicit mention of them at the encampment when I've been there, or in the list of demands, and I'm curious if that's something that comes up and if there is a kind of position on that or how to communicate about that. When an Israeli, a pro-Israeli student who comes and says, my main concern is getting the hostages back. Why are you talking about what's happening in Palestine? What about me?
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing just to start off, since you mentioned the hostages, is that Israel rejected a hostage deal, like, I think yesterday or the day before. I agree that, you know, we should release hostages. And I think that when we talk about hostages, we also have to talk about the thousands of Palestinian hostages held in Israeli prisons. But to broadly speaking, I think that as a, you know, Students for Justice in Palestine, as a part of the Palestinian Liberation Solidarity Movement, what we care about is ending the injustice that have led to all of these circumstances to begin with. And when we talk about October 7th, we have to understand the context and the history of injustice that led to that. And our position is that we have to get to a lasting peace, which is really, I think, what we all want. We have to end the conditions of injustice that have led to this violence.
Right. And so when you came, you've been here for a year, right? You're a first year graduate student originally from California, but with strong familial ties to Palestine and to Gaza in particular. So when you came here to begin your academic career, did you have any idea that you might end up being part of a people's university on, or a popular university on the Library Mall? And what do you think you've learned since, you know, the situations have led to that for you?
Yeah, well, not at all. I did not anticipate this. You know, I've been involved in Palestine protests before because that's part of my background. But I think the wave of both student movements and broader movements across the U.S. and the world to stand up in solidarity with Palestine is unprecedented. We haven't seen anything like this for Palestine in the U.S. or globally. It's so tragic that it took such horror to get to this place. But I'm inspired by the dedication I have seen from students across the country, from students and community members in Madison specifically. And I think that these encampments are kind of a microcosm of how we build towards a better future.
And the encampments themselves as a symbol is something that I've thought about a lot too, and that has been discussed, because in terms of a tactic for bringing this protest and the demands for change that the students and the supporters of the encampment have, because, you know, in past years in student protests, what has often happened, other than demonstrating outside on campus, has been to occupy buildings. And it seems like that's been a tactic that, at least here at the UW-Madison and many of the other encampments, that step has not been taken. But the tents themselves, why tents is, I guess, the way I would pose it. I mean, why don't you just come out there every day and spend the day there and then come back every day? And
yeah, I mean, I think the tents have an incredibly strong symbolic meaning, which is in solidarity specifically with the people of Rafah and the people of Gaza who have been displaced from their homes and are currently living in tents, many of whom are facing starvation. They don't have access to water. They don't have access to electricity. They don't have access to heating and cooling, as it's now been like over 100 degrees some days. And so the tents are a reminder of the fact that so many people in Gaza have lost so much from this genocide, and we need to center that in the way that we discuss how we move forward.
So we've got about 5 minutes left in the show. We've talked about, I think, the things that may answer this question already, but what do you feel is the most important thing that you want listeners here to know and the general public to know about the encampment and about the demands for divestment?
Yeah, I think the most important thing here is that the university is complicit not just in the ongoing genocide, but in the decades of violence, occupation, colonization that have happened before through these companies that it invests in. And so that's really what this encampment is about, disrupting these structures of accountability and making sure that the university is accountable to students and community members in its investments of our money.
Right. And so your motivation for, and the motivation of many of the other students there as well, who have these direct connections to Gaza and to Palestine itself in terms of through your family. Is it the U.S., you are a U.S. citizen,
yes,
right? And so your focus is on what the U.S. government is doing and the connection between the university's money and what that money is being used for by the government. So do you see this as a kind of civic action by yourself,
yeah,
as a student? I mean, yeah, as a citizen.
I think when people ask me, like, why do you care about this? I always have two answers. The first one is, I mean, just chronologically, the first one is because I'm Palestinian. But I would say the bigger one is that it's because I'm American. It's because it's my taxpayer dollars. It's my, you know, tuition or research dollars that go towards funding this. And the U.S. has, apart from Israel itself, the most control out of any country in the world over what's happening. And so I think all of us have a responsibility to do what we can to fight this.
In the last couple of minutes here, just thinking about all the news that I've been consuming, both from visiting the encampment and from just consuming news online and on TV, one of the most recent interesting things that happened, and maybe you have listened to the talk as well, was the resignation of, and I can't think of her name right now, of a State Department employee who just resigned, and maybe you haven't heard this, from the State Department. She was interviewed in depth on the Democracy Now! Program.
Oh, wow.
By Amy Goodman, and she is the first actual State Department staff member who worked for the State Department. She was the Arabic language sort of media person, mm-hmm, for the State Department, whose responsibility was to report back to the State Department on what was being said in the Arab media about,
yeah,
the war in Gaza. She's based, I think, in Dubai or Doha. And I guess I'd actually been thinking that maybe we could play a clip from that, but we don't have time right now. It was, but anyway, she spent the months before she resigned trying to communicate with her bosses at the State Department that the policy that they were following right now was a failed policy. It was just,
yeah,
not working, and nobody was listening to her. So she said, I'm out of here.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's what we've seen, is that our elected officials, you know, both elected and also whatever bureaucracy, but really our elected officials have been completely unaccountable to the public demands of the people. And I think that's the biggest issue at play in terms of American politics here.
Lee, do you have any other questions?
I do not. Okay. Well, I have many, but it's time to quit.
Yes.
So thank you. Thank you so much, Dalia, for coming in. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, and thanks to both of you for having me on.
Glad to. Anytime. And that's Worldview for this week. And I have to say thank you to the Worldview Collective, Gil Halstead, Buya Jame, Savi Etiya, Maria Brunetta, and special thanks to our guest engineer, Jay Davis, and to WORT News and Public Affairs Director, Shali Pittman. And thank you for listening, and please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-sponsored radio, WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. And now stay tuned for Salamat.
Worldview is written and produced by a collective of volunteers. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also contact us here at this station if you're interested in joining our collective to bring world issues to the airwaves. Worldview can be heard every Sunday
from 5 to 6 p.m. on WORT 89.9 FM.
Right On release tour with Creekbed Carter Hogan on Thursday, May 16th at the High Noon Saloon. The brainchild of singer-songwriter Suri Undlin, Humbird stretches between experimental folk and environmental Americana. The central tenet of Humbird's third full-length album, Right On, is uncertainty as a radical ethos in this soapbox age and an effort worth turning up the amps for, resulting in the project's most electric, playful, meddled record yet. Opener Creekbed Carter Hogan is a trans folk singer who showcases a unique blend of self-taught folk picking and queer mayhem. FPC Live presents Humbird, Right On release tour with Creekbed Carter Hogan on Thursday, May 16th at the High Noon Saloon. Live music lives at WORT Madison.
In Arabic, we say a bunch of things, but today in particular, أكل البيضة والتأشيرة. Translation, he ate the egg and the eggshell. Greedy to the point of not knowing what to consume or keep.